And welcome to Here We Stand. I'm your host, Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice, and we're back. It's the dawn of another age, of course, another year, another program. And this show is especially going out to some of our listeners down there in Berkeley, California, Oakland, a new group of supporters there. And it's appropriate we start with Phil Oakes, the 60s folk singer. He used to sing those songs in Berkeley. He helped lead the free speech movement there in the early 60s that sparked so much of the change coming out of that beautiful, brilliant era. And we are carrying on that struggle today. The struggle for free speech and human liberty never ends, brothers and sisters. Today, we're going to be talking about spiritual sovereignty and soul freedom in our time, uniting the inner and the outer battles. And that, of course, is the challenge. I'm honored to have with me as my co-host, Deborah Golding. You've had the honor of listening to her before. She's been on our show twice. She's a survivor of the Mormon so-called Latter-day Saints Church in Salt Lake City. She's a wellness coach and a leader in the struggle to expose these crimes and stop them. And we are here every Sunday, 3 p.m. Pacific time. Follow her work, murderbydecree.com. I wanted to start out with just an observation from one of my books, The Border. A few can rule over the many only when the many have been systematically traumatized into permanent patterns of obedient thought and behavior. That's why child abuse is not a crime, folks. It's part of the way they control us. And today we're going to be talking about the lessons we've learned along the way and how we can apply it to freeing not only our souls and our minds, but those around us from these horrible crimes that are ongoing. Before I bring Deborah on, just a couple of announcements. We mentioned last week about the Common Law Training School starting mid-January to commemorate the 5th anniversary of the proclamation of the Republic of Kanata. And there's two scheduled right now, this coming Saturday at 12 noon in Vancouver. That's Saturday, January 18th. And then the following Sunday, a week Sunday, January the 26th in Toronto. If you want to register for those common law training schools, just write to republicofcanada@gmail.com. Also, on next Sunday, I'll be giving a lot more information, which people have been asking about as well. What is this press conference you're doing, Kev, on the January 23rd, the 25th anniversary of my firing by the United Church that helped kick off this whole wonderful movement? Well, you'll find out next week. I'll disclose more things then. For all of you folks who just can't wait, too bad, you'll have to wait till next Sunday to learn. So without further ado, let me bring on Deborah. Hi, Deb.
Hi. How are you today?
Well, I'm doing fine. How about you?
I'm good. I'm excited to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Well, great. It's always good to have you because, you know, we go deeper in our discussions than just the obvious stuff. And I wondered if you could, for folks who are listening for the first time, whether you could talk a little bit about some of your background and the things that are important for you to be talking about today on the show.
Well, my experience really started at birth. So I was born into the cult, the Mormon LDS Church, and didn't really recognize it as such, obviously. But it was my experience really started at birth, and it went till I was accessible to the people that were my handlers and family members and such until I was about 36 years old, which meant that I was also, my children were also available to these experiences as well with satanic ritual abuse. And so that's part of the system that, you know, is really well refined and defined in all of this. But I repressed all of my experiences. I mean, there were little clues here and there, but nothing that could really be connected, you know, necessarily have the experience either as a child or even as a teenager to understand some of the behaviors that I thought were just part of my personality and were to be celebrated or to be repressed or, you know, to be shamed mm-hmm. or something like that. So anyway, so I went through that. I was present at high-level LDS church ceremonies, murders, sacrifices, rapes. I was also a part of that as a victim myself, and it was also expressed on a family level as well. So it was pretty thorough. I actually have I went through a very focused and intense memory recovery therapy for a number of years. And, you know, the reason I got into that because I just thought I was depressed. And I thought, wow, you know, this is really odd. I'm not this kind of a person. I don't understand depression really. So I know that this is what I think depression looks like. I'm going to go seek some help. And that was done completely from fear. I mean, I had to push through a tremendous amount of fear to even seek out a therapist. Luckily, I was very, very fortunate. I've got to say it was divinely guided that I found a therapist that specialized in ritual abuse. And I was guided that direction because I actually had a friend who could see some of the signs, and she was very familiar with what that was, this underbelly of this church. And so she, you know, I was given the therapist's name and phone number, and it took a lot for me to do that because it's such a taboo thing within the culture to even look outside of ecclesiastical counseling for anything, really. So that was quite an experience for me, and immediately I was ready to start showing myself what my other life was really about, and it was very detailed. What I was pulling up was a lot of details, and went through that for a number of years, and what that did end up with was kind of what I want to call it. It just like shattered everything. It shattered my belief system. It shattered my identity. Right. It shattered everything. And so then it also shattered my marriage. It ended up in a divorce. It ended up in me losing, quote unquote, losing everything. But what that did is it actually got rid of the anchored in falsities, false beliefs and falseness that I was being run by, and right. opened up the door for really my own empowerment and my self-knowing.
Right.
And that's really what's been so powerful for me.
That's what I want to focus on today, and I know you were interested in doing this as well. Looking mm-hmm. not so much as the crime, because it's documented in our other, of course, in lots of our work. We know the gory mm-hmm. details, and we're going to talk more about the Mormon Church, especially some things that have been in the news recently about them. But the thing I think it's really valuable, especially for other veterans of these crimes who are listening in, is the strength you've acquired from it and the lessons you've learned in the process of what to avoid, what not to do, and how we can apply these to the work with people. So mm-hmm. maybe before we get into that, I know that you had a news item. It's been in the news. And this is, we've talked about the close parallels and the alliance between the Mormon Church and the Roman Catholic Church and the Vatican. I think this is more proof of it. Do you want to share that item?
Oh, yeah. It was pretty earth-shattering. It was groundbreaking in a lot of ways. So back in December, on the 17th of December, the Washington Post actually put an article out there, and the title of it is, "The Mormon Church has misled members on $100 billion tax-exempt investment fund," a whistleblower alleges. And there was like a 73-page document that was submitted to the IRS by a senior portfolio manager in the investment division of the LDS Church, saying, look, this is what I'm seeing, this is what I've noted, and I've been collecting this data for a number of years, and I'm appalled. And so if people want to go read the entire article, it is in the Washington Post, and it was put up on December 17th. But basically, the IRS is now investigating the church for $100 million tax-exempt investment funds. And, you know, the thing that's so crazy about this is it's like you suspect it. And the church, you know, over my lifetime, they have their general conferences, which is where they twice a year, then there's 2 days worth of talks that the leaders of the church go, you know, like prepare for, and then just kind of broadcast worldwide. And in one of these, they always give a report of the funds and, you know, how the church is handling the tithes and offerings that are coming into the church. Well, all those numbers are always skewed. Nobody really, it's always kind of like, well, it's percentages are not really forthcoming, and numbers aren't necessarily forthcoming. And so people suspected that there was maybe some discrepancies, but, you know, I mean, you know, they're a religious entity. It's 501c3. They're tax exempt. You know, we trust that they're using our tithes and offerings in proper ways. And this was not just so shocking, but it was blatantly, you know, betraying.
Let's restate that for a minute. We're talking about $100 billion dollars, correct?
Correct, yes. Yeah. So the way this works is the church basically, according to this article, the church takes in $7 billion a year in contributions. This is based on...
Okay, stop it right there. Let's do this piece by piece. We're talking about a church of 13 million members, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think it was the figure I read a few years ago was about 13 million members. They're taking in the income at the level of the Vatican or a nation state, right?
Yes. Yes,
like,
that's what's being declared here, yes.
Okay, so that's a red flag right there. Okay, carry on, sorry.
No, that's just fine. It was the numbers that are being cited, and this is what's going into the report to the IRS. So this is what, this is what the Washington Post is reporting, is basically the church is taking in, and this is as of the article in December 17th, 2019. So we're just, a few months after this article, or even, a month after. $7 billion a year in contributions. Now, this is all coming from what is considered and what is titled tithes and offerings. So in the Mormon Church, they are very, they've taken the use of tithing 10% of your income to a requirement / art form. So the Mormons are very obviously good at their donations. And there's promises, it's kind of reinforced by, the promises that and the blessings that God is going to give you because you're doing what is being asked of you by your church leaders and also what is stated in the Bible to do, bring in these tithes and offerings to the storehouses kind of idea. So $7 billion is being donated. These are contributions. So,
and what is remind folks again, what is this $100 billion again? Clarify what that
okay.
is.
Okay. The $100 billion, this is where I'm getting to. So there's $7 billion coming in every year. $6 billion is claimed to be used for operational costs of the church. So then what they do is they take $1 billion and they transfer the $1 billion to the investment portfolio managers of their own. They have their own church portfolio management company, Ensign. And what their instructions are to do is, take the $1 billion and put them into portfolios to generate returns. So it's clearly stated we want to create income off of this as well. So the it reports to the portfolio now that was started out, and this is the numbers from 1997. It went from $12 billion in 1997 to now $100 billion in 2019.
Jesus.
So that's
almost
just
a tenfold
from the portfolio.
Increase.
Correct.
Okay, so do they account where this is coming from? What are they doing, investing in the arms industry or like the way the Vatican Bank does or what?
Yeah. The reply, there was an official reply that did come, a couple of them actually, that did come from the church. And basically the sweeping narrative that comes here is basically this is supposed to be kind of a faith-promoting story. So the larger picture is, and this is coming from a church official, is quote, if people would see the larger picture on church finances, they would, quote unquote, see that the church is not a profit-making business, end quote. So they're basically saying, hey, you know what? We're doing exactly what is being prescribed by God, which is putting aside our own tenth and then, allowing that to be there for a rainy day. So
well,
really what they're doing clearly, though,
that's
is,
what they may say,
yes,
but what do you think is going on? Like their church leaders always said that, like the Anglican Church was investing in landmine companies and they said it's, for the good of the church. But what do you think is going on?
Well, part of the two things. Clearly in the article, one of the reasons why it got submitted in the first place is as a tax-exempt entity, they're supposed to be doing, contributing and using those funds to help the poor and the needy. But what they did in this case is it was cited that they bailed out Beneficial Life. It's a life insurance company that they own. They used $600 million to bail them out in 2009. And then they've also put around $1.4 billion of installments into City Creek Mall. It's a shopping center in downtown Salt Lake City
so
that the church owns.
Right there, they shouldn't have tax-exempt status because under American tax laws, if you're a charity or a religious institution, all of your money has to go towards relief of the poor, doing charitable works, or propagating religion.
Right.
And this is not opening malls and bailing out insurance companies, right?
Correct. And so those are the two things that were cited in the article. Now, I do know from personal experience, you know, one of the things that the church does have is that they celebrate. They do have this very well established. This is, you know, well known that the church has what's called the welfare square, welfare center. So basically, it is an operating extension of the church that contributes supplies and funds and all kinds of things to disasters. So, you know, when there's been hurricanes or when there's been famine or when there's been stuff, they have actually and very effectively been able to put supplies and things onto and ship them over to where they're needed. So to help, you know, with blankets and things like that. So they have something in process. Okay. And then as a member of the church, you know, you can also request help if you need it. So, you know, if you can't pay your light bill, right, you can actually ask the bishop of the ward that you're a member of if you could have some assistance, and they have funds to help you with that. The problem with that is, you know, that they have all of this money, and you still have to go through some criteria to quote-unquote qualify for it. So after my divorce...
Well, apparently you tried and they didn't give you that much,
I did,
correct?
Yeah. After my divorce, I needed some help to pay rent I needed some financial help. And so I appealed to... I was still attending church at the time, and I wanted to be near my kids. You know, the divorce, it was just, you know, one of those things that I thought was probably the best, so I could see my kids and be near them and, you know, have that extra time with them and kind of ease with the unfamiliarity of that divorce landscape. But anyway, I did request some help, and I had been paying out, understanding that my family, I was born into this church, and so I was taught by the age of 8, this is when you start paying your tithing, because you're baptized at 8, so now you're quote-unquote an official member, and on Fast Sunday, you're going to start fasting, and you're also going to pay into this tithes and offerings fund. And so I would pay 10% of whatever it was I earned, whether it was a dime or whether it was, you know, $10 or whatever. So, and so for my lifetime, since the age of 8, I have been contributing to this fund. And it's gone into whatever it's gone into, obviously.
Okay.
They said, sure, we can help you out for a little while. So I basically got $500 for 3 months. And that was it. And they said, you know what, we really can't keep supporting you in this manner. So, it's just not working for us. And I'm just like...
So you pay into this thing for years, and you get $1,500 back.
Correct. Yeah, that's
it. So it's like
and
the
there
insurance
was really
company
no
ripoff.
Yeah.
Okay, no appeal,
yeah.
The whole thing. So a fraudulent ripoff, in other words.
In this case, yeah. I mean, I would say off, and part of the policy, too. And, you know, I can even, quote the prophet himself. I mean, he came out and was talking about tithing, and he was saying, you know, to the poorest of the poor, if you need to choose between, you know, like paying your tithing and then, I don't know if he said paying your light bill, but it is also, you know, paying some kind of utility or bill, you pay your tithing because then you're blessed by God. And so,
right, of course.
Even
yeah. This just sounds so much like the Roman Catholic Church. It's the same con job that's come out of Rome for 2,000 years. You know, soak people to, and, you know, God needs the cash, right? That fallacy. But let's apply this to how we started. Let's apply all of this obvious corruption going on with, as a veteran, and sometimes, I don't know if you like the word survivor or veteran, but of these heinous crimes,
like
the torture and killing of children. How do we, you know, apply this knowledge, and what's been your experience when you're working with survivors and veterans of these things? How much are they willing to look at about all this stuff?
Oh, man, that's so individual. I know for me, reclaiming myself was the most important thing that I could do, because what that does is, you know, you and I have spoken before, and that quote, you know thyself. Where did you say that's written? That's Greek or something, right? I mean, there was just know thyself.
On the Temple of Delphi, thousands of years old, it says the source of all wisdom is to know yourself. Yeah.
Okay, so here's what's so beautiful about how you just framed that. The source of all wisdom is to know thyself, and knowing that inner landscape, the importance of this self-empowerment of knowing yourself and really just being courageous enough to travel this journey and then check back in and really just kind of looking at, you know, how am I reflecting myself? What is this looking like to me? What are these shadow parts of myself, and what are they telling me? You know, not even trying to evaluate them mentally. It's like listening to the voice of your experience that says these ugly, mm-hmm. ugly things are part of your experience, and then choosing to believe that, and then letting it get refined and really getting the details of it. That is so powerful, because it is like the key to the whole clarity and the, you know, of being, of knowing yourself. But counter to that, the efforts that are put into isolating yourself from yourself, isolating people from themselves and from relating to others and having that community relationship is incredible. I mean, religion is set up so that you feel like you're part of a community, and people, humans, yearn to be a part of something. But what it does is it basically isolates the individual in a way where you can't really relate unless you relate in the conforming ways. And so right. the marketing and the diverting and the distracting is, it's just bombarding us all the time, all around us. And so it takes effort and it takes practice to get to this self-knowing. Right. And so when I first started into my therapy, my thought was, cool, we'll hit this for a couple of months. And then I realized, well, no. But maybe, you know, this maybe take a year or two. You know, and I remember as I'd gotten into it further and further, probably 3-4 years into it, I thought, if this is going to take me 8 years, I'm going to be like pissed off. Come on. You know, it did. It was 8 years. But I just, you know, trying to think that I would be in this process of discovery, and it was such heinous, hard work. But it is the most empowering thing I've ever done. I am so much clearer. The person I am now is not the person I was then, and the evolution okay. of who I am.
Well, so here's the problem, because so many of the people we work with are not like that. As a matter of fact, the vast majority of people aren't. They're stuck, and you know, I've both witnessed this in groups of mm-hmm. survivors, that they're stuck in their mm-hmm. own pain. They're Stockholm syndromed, as in they are looking for the good in the very institution that destroyed their lives. They're constantly defending mm-hmm. them. They're down-pedaling what they're saying. They're not naming right. names. Okay. Now, and what adds to it is this, and we talked about this earlier, the two worlds everybody lives in. You know, down Salt Lake City, people are walking in the sunlight, having fun, enjoying their families. Meanwhile, in the temple, children are being ritually sacrificed. And
correct.
All of us live in those two worlds. We don't want to look at the horrible stuff, and so we can afford to be dissociated in that way. But survivors don't have the luxury to keep those worlds separate, because it'll cost them their life, right?
It does. In a very real sense, it does, because my experience and that sense as a survivor, you know, deep down inside, you know that if you choose to actually indulge in this, I'm using the words purposely, to indulge in allowing this to come together, you do lose your sense of identity. You will die. You, as the person that you know yourself to be, will die. And you're not really sure, I mean, you're not really given surety, because it's not modeled anywhere else, at least in your reality at the moment. You don't have a lot of security knowing that you're going to actually rise like a phoenix. You don't know that you're going to come back better. You don't know that you're even going to come back from it. And so the risk in the moment, especially of the fear of the unknown, is huge. And this is why I think it's so important that that survivors and veterans really do actually speak out. Like your story, you know, what's happened with you in your observations and in your personal experience is so valuable. My story in saying, hey, look, you know what, this is really what I went through. This is really my experience, and I lost. Right. I no longer talk to my parents. I don't have extended family. My kids don't have grandparents. However, the rebuild of who I am, the person that I am, you know, I can say I am, versus I'm this chameleon that can conform to anything and everything and be controlled. And you don't necessarily see yourself that way. To be honest, when I was in the middle of this whole process, my therapist was so wise, and when he would say, you know, I would say, wow, you know what, this discovery, I could go, wow, this explains a few things. And he would always kind of cap it with, and you're worth it. You're so worth this. And I just right. really, it took me years to actually understand and agree right. with that statement, you know, but I still kept going. I kept going until I actually did get that, oh my gosh, you know what, I am worth it. Oh my gosh, you bet your okay. boots I'm worth it, you know?
One of the things that we did want to touch on is lessons learned. And I know you're beginning to touch on that now, and I know that both of us have had these kind of hard-won lessons over the years. And in a way, it sets us apart because it's very hard to communicate with people who haven't been through that experience. They still have a lot of illusions. We talked earlier about even when you've been violated by these churches and or society generally, you automatically look to the very institutions that did you the harm for an answer. Okay?
Correct. Yes.
So let's talk a little bit about that. And I think in my one of the articles I wrote called The Forgiveness Fallacy, we get into that.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Well, why don't I would really like to hear, I mean, because the forgiveness fallacy is aptly entitled, the forgiveness fallacy addresses something that I personally discovered, which is this falseness fallacy about what forgiveness really means. You know, I mean, this idea of forgiving and forgetting never sat right with me, especially as I began to uncover and realize how heinous and violating and soul-killing everything that I what had been experiencing really was. And I'm just thinking, no, tell me how one can forgive it. How do you forgive that under the umbrella of its current definition? And so, you know, I was actually reading this in your book, The Border, and I started underlining like, oh my gosh, this is exactly what I've been thinking. This is exactly what I thought. And so, I would love for you to, if you wouldn't mind, like, you know, just share with everybody, share with me again, this forgiveness fallacy, because it's a hard one to sit with. And I'm going to ask people that are listening to this, just sit with this for a moment. And if you don't agree with it, that's fine, but give it some weight, give it some space to really kind of understand. And if you don't, ask more questions about it. You know, I mean, like, what does this really mean? So, I mean, go ahead. I would love to hear this.
Thanks, Deb. I mean, it's important because it comes at a raw experience. And it's funny when I say this to most people are very hostile when I even suggest that forgiveness is not something we should be doing. This is taken from my book, The Border, which you can get at Amazon. It's on page 194, one of the chapters entitled Letting Go of Slavery, The Forgiveness Fallacy. And what I started by saying, look, my observations in the healing circles was that it was the native people who didn't forgive, who were the most angry, who were the healthiest. They were the ones who came out and spoke to the reporters. They were able to talk about their pain because they said, I'm never going to forgive these bastards for what they did. Mm-hmm. But the other ones who were convinced and brainwashed that, oh, we have to get along with, we have to, you know, the residential school survivors even issued a, well, they didn't, the puppet Indian chiefs did on their behalf, issued a, they called it a forgiveness charter to the government and churches of Canada. Oh, you know, how can you even do that on behalf of 80,000 murdered children? You know, you can't forgive on behalf of somebody else. But the slave way of thinking, where we have to forgive our abuser or we're a bad person and we can't recover, it's nonsense in practice. And I don't even know why therapists even believe that, because the empirical data shows quite the opposite. And we trace it historically, and you find that it's coming out, the whole biblical message is that, you know, God is his father. You're to go along with the authority figure, and if you don't, you've got the problem. So it's always a question of the abuser is fine. The crime isn't the problem. Mm-hmm. It's speaking about it that is. And it even says that in the Catholic policy of crimen solicitandis. If you talk about a crime, or you talk about the rape of a child, that's a crime. The rape itself isn't. It's a sin that can be forgiven. But you talk about it, and you're expelled from the church. So the father figure can never do any wrong. We have committed the wrong by talking about it, and if we forgive our abuser, basically so they can do it again, then we're a good person. So it's all this hierarchical, oppressive, slave thinking. And just to end on that, and we can talk about all this, if you look at Jesus' word for forgiveness, because people are always saying, oh, look at what Jesus said. You know, you have to forgive your enemy, love your enemy.
Right.
That's not what the word says in Greek. The Greek word for forgiveness that he uses, the translation from the New Testament, is aphemi. And aphemi means to send something or someone away or separate from them, as in a divorce. Mm-hmm. So in other words, to forgive means you separate from the one who's done it to you. You say, I'm leaving you now. I'm walking in a different direction. I'm not like you. And that's right. different than getting into bed with them and reconciling with them, which is the shit you hear all the time. So, So in other words, it's a very radical message. It's saying if you've been harmed by somebody, you don't have to forgive. You have to own your own voice and never surrender that voice and your justifiable rage and anger until you see justice done. That's healthy. But, you know, feeling we have to, you know, reconcile, and that's a word you hear all the time in Canada. And, you know, it's a horrible word because it means to be basically accommodate to your own pain and suffering and injustice.
Accommodate to your own pain. You know, there's so many, like that, unfortunately, that is so many people's, like, real, that is the state of what they're walking around in, is accommodation. I'm accommodating this pain, this inner pain, you know, and we're always weak. The idea of self-medication comes out in a number of different ways, but, you know, this fosters it. I mean, I even remember reading in you know, a quote that you put in here. It's like, by doing this is in this manner, a deep bitterness and shame is instilled in the victim, and the cycle of abuse and torture continues. It's like, well, yes.
Yeah.
That's exactly what happens. And it's so,
meant to continue. Yeah.
Exactly. It strips. Even mentally, I mean, well, in so many different ways, but as I was considering, you know, now I was never counseled in my therapy. I was never counseled to do this. This, thank goodness, I wasn't counseled to go and forgive my perpetrators at all. It was more of empowering myself, discover yourself, finding more and more of my own authenticity by stripping away these falsehoods. That was the goal. And then what started appearing on this inner landscape was astounding to me. Not just here's your story and look how heinous, but look at you. Like I was finding this voice and I was finding this understanding of myself that I really didn't have definition for, but began to really deeply love and appreciate. And no part of that self was wanting to then turn to my abusers and say, well, you know, let's sit down and talk about this. At the time, what I ended up doing was actually looking at my family, my parents especially, and I'm like, I am not going to associate with you, and I am not going to associate with the church either. But it was specifically to them because they were so close to me, and that I had to go through some very real practices of, like, I wrote down on a 3x5 card what I would say, and I would have that in my purse or in my pocket or something just in case. Somehow I got blindsided because when I told them I'm no longer associating, then all of a sudden I'm getting hit from all different kinds of directions,
well,
of, you know, craziness that was coming through.
That's the thing. It's like there's this moral qualifying test, and mm-hmm. even non-Christian counselors do it all the time. They say, if you don't forgive, you're not going to recover. Well, why is forgiveness necessary for recovery? The point is that you're expected to heal on the terms of the abuser. So, for example, I get this all the time when I first began to talk about the genocide. Why are you bringing this up? It's only going to cause pain and division. Well, hello, there's already pain and division. There's children in the ground. There's people killing themselves. It's just not affecting you. So everything is from the perspective of the abuser, which in this case is the dominant culture, right? The reason people are afraid of challenging the forgiveness fallacy is because it's the old ingrained fear of parental retaliation, right? Mm-hmm. You know, when the Pope mm-hmm. raises his arm or a world leader raises his arm, apparently in welcoming, it's really the raised hand of the parent. It's neurolinguistic programming. And that raised hand of the parent, it will strike you if you're a bad boy and you say, no, I'm not going to heal on your terms. I need to keep my story. I'm going to tell the truth, right? And so that raised hand is over every one of us, and it's why people don't get on board with our campaign. They're afraid to talk about child killing, even though it's proven that it's happening everywhere, right?
Well, honestly, it's a revolutionary act. I remember even thinking, I had so many examples coming through on really who I saw as revolutionaries, and one of the obvious ones for me was, you know, and especially in religion, was Jesus. Jesus was not... He was not there as somebody that was going to do. I mean, the idea mm-hmm. and the commandment, quote unquote, to say you love one another went completely against a lot of different things. Like he basically even came in and says, you know, in me fulfills all the laws and the prophets. And oh my gosh, talk about heresy! So So, I mean, we can go into that at some other time, but, you know, he's basically...
Well, no, and it's really relevant because it's like, I would often, I made a point in sermons of saying, look, Jesus not only said, love your enemy, he also said, I've come to set father against son and mother against daughter. I come not to bring peace but a sword, because the most important thing to him was not people getting along, was not forgiving and loving, it was the truth, heavenly truth. Right.
I remember the first time I actually read that passage, and I'm like, that makes so much sense to me. But I was living that. Yeah, no, go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt, but it just...
Well, no, it's all part of the same thing. Yeah, because it's like the phony culture in churches, and it's true in all of them. You know, they're saying one thing and doing... They're the embodiment of hypocrisy, because what it's really supposed... It's designed not for God or for truth. It's designed to comfort people on the terms of the dominant culture, which is you will not disturb any vested interest, right? You will turn the other way when children are being raped, trafficked, and killed, because churches are the perfect cover for crime, and they always have been.
Right. But see, now, take this in. Let's take everything that was just said there, and imagine yourself, whether, you know, whoever you are right now, you know, bring all of that into yourself and see how that feels, because really, to look at this and hold that and be very honest about that, it is a revolutionary thought where you might like it, you might not like it, but this idea for any of this to happen, okay, now as a victim, for any recovery to even happen, it's a revolutionary act even within your own self, and thus the reality of really supporting that courage of, I'm going to have a revolution going on inside of myself, and I don't know where this is going to end up, is huge.
Right.
It's huge.
It's like standing on a cliff, and a lot of people don't want to go there. But, you know, I often say to people, there's a difference between doing something out of a good intention and doing something because your life depends on it. More and more of us realize that our lives depend on waking up, because it could be us tomorrow.
My gosh.
It's happening right now, right?
Yes.
And it's not an abstract issue. When your kids are taken from you, you know, like mine have been, when you're turned into a pariah and a black sheep, when you're attacked in many ways, you're in their crosshairs. You're a target. And you and me and people like us don't have the luxury of having illusions, right?
No. And you've pointed this out before too. This is not just a quiet personal revolutionary act, which it is. But in addition to that, it's a whole entire belief system. You know, you are revolting against your own belief system, and you're also revolting against the culture you're in. So then all of a sudden, it's a revolution against I think you even stated it once, it's a political act. And this transformation that actually comes from it, depending on how very real this starts to become, you know, like resonate within you and what this personal landscape is that you see, it turns into a confrontation between yourself and your culture. But then, I love this, again, I'm sorry, I've got to quote you in the border. It says, achieving personal change and self-governance requires a fundamental social transformation through a corresponding collective self-governance. Now, if you want to take that on the macro and the micro, you have to. Self-governance within yourself is even a practice that has to happen. And so, you know, in lessons learned, being responsible for yourself is huge. I remember when I did finally take the step of moving out and stepping into, I looked in the calendar on that date and I named it my sovereignty day. Like I really made a title for that, and I didn't necessarily understand everything I was doing, but I had to leave my marriage and I had to leave the situation. And so for me, this was a statement of sovereignty, and I had to do that personally. But now, you know, even on this globe, you know, in a broader stretch, what you're doing inside is really what's going to be reflected outside. And that act is also part of the lessons that I've been learning and lessons learned from what comes from actually doing this. And, you know, as you've been learning, how have you seen this forgiveness factor playing into your life? Like, where are you seeing that reflected for you?
Well, I'm going to answer that, but I wanted to say something you said as well, just to respond to that, because what we're doing is analogous to 500 years ago in the Reformation. Why were people being burned alive for owning a Bible? Or like William Tyndale, who translated the first Bible into English, and he was burned at the stake, the Catholic Church hunting him down and finally burned him. Why? Because when people can look at that for themselves and come to their own conclusions, the whole edifice of religion crumbles, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the Church knew it. And it's the same thing now. Once we pierce through this lie of organized religion and the crime that stands behind it, and the frankly, the satanic force that stands behind it, right, then the whole basis of elite rule in our culture collapses, because how do a few govern the many? It's by traumatizing at a young age and by getting people too afraid to even think. And I'm speaking to a lot of Canadians here, because that's the experience of my culture, so-called culture, and that people in Canada police themselves and are too afraid to even think of these things. You know, they don't need a police state. They police themselves. They cannot imagine going against constituted authority. That, and even when they do try, and I want to talk about this with you too, it's all controlled. You know, the most conservative people are those people on a protest, because all they're doing is saying, please, government, give us change. They're not creating that change themselves, right?
Oh,
so
that's such a good point.
Let's talk about that. And in terms of, oh, and you did ask me a question, though, about forgiveness in my life, but that's kind of a big one. Because,
I see
no need to forgive. I don't hate. It's a waste of energy and time. But I will, to forgive is to also forget and to lose the sharp edge, because it isn't me. It's this children out there that are still suffering who need me not to forgive. Because as soon as I forgive, I've accommodated to the crime that's still going on. And it would be one thing if it all ended years ago, right? And it's all over, and now we've got it, which is the way the dominant culture always portray these things. Oh, we've apologized. It's all over now, right? But the point is, it isn't over, and it doesn't end, and so we don't have the luxury of forgiveness and turning away, because then we're helping kill those children, right?
And what I feel like you and I are bringing up, and where this is going, especially with the title of our conversation today, is really that the inner and the outer. So it's not forgetting at all, and yet it's kind of merging. It's like, now where do we go with this? With merging the inner, the spiritual landscape, the outer, the 3D landscape. That these factors that create this entire scenario. You know, when you're talking about people self-governing themselves, it's right now. I mean, the scope, the lens is such a narrow lens, you know, and it's groomed that way. It's groomed to be, you know, this is it. This is your reality. And I think that's where I get so impassioned in what I've discovered and what I know about, you know, all of this with the church and the sacrifices and the you know, killing the children and of people and that kind of all of those things. I get impassioned when I want to say, look, here's the deal. And for want of a better way to describe it, it's like you think you're stepping up to a meal, and what you see in front of you is the plate that's been set before you and the meal, you know, the food that is on the plate. And what I want to do is say, you know what, there's a banquet. There is so much more information sitting here. Like, check out the entire story. Here is all of the information. Don't think that your reality is just what is set in front of you. You know what? And you might not like everything that's in front of you. You might not find this savory, but the point is, it's still there. You know, and you don't have to.
This is especially relevant when you're working with people. You know, when we started the conversation and talked about how few people are at your place where you're willing to name these things, they're still very caught up in fear and their own pain, and the perpetrators know this. The churches and the others behind them know this, and so they create these controlled oppositions. You have this in Ireland and Canada and the U.S. As soon as the truth comes out, or well before it, these church killers know that it's going to come out one day, so they fashion this response beforehand. Like you mentioned that Mormon survivors have a process whereby the church itself is monitoring their, quote, healing, You know, we've seen the same thing. They set up front groups in other countries, official survivors organizations funded by the government that will steer away from certain issues like mass murder and genocide and sterilization programs. You know, so it's a controlled response that the churches already have in place before anyone even speaks out.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, honestly, when you're in that system, and especially in the satanic ritual system, I mean, there's definite programming that goes on, and one of the main things that, like, everybody contains, the part of the programming is to, when you start recalling this, is you are programmed to talk, and you're going to tell somebody, and typically you're going to tell somebody you trust, and typically the person you trust is your own handler. So you're going to be revealing and exposing right. yourself to the very perpetrators that are right. keeping you in that horrific system. And so then they have this entire catch net for this. And so right. then if you go and you say, and then they're like, okay, well, it, you know, obviously, you know, how severe is this memory, you know, that this person is pulling up? And so they'll act all concerned and questioning, and you may end up in the state hospital. You may end up in, you know, LDS
right.
social services.
You've got the problem. Like what the missionaries
exactly.
said to the Indians. Right. You
yeah,
have the problem.
You've got the problem.
That's the mentality. It's always the victim who has the problem, not the people who did it. Right.
And, right, and they have their catch net to actually contain that. So you're going to go to one right. of their counselors. You're going to go to one of their therapists. They're going to give you, you know, their version of the drugs, and they're going to say, "Oh, here's a group that, you know, can help you with this." And it's all the same. It's all right. meant to keep you contained and, you know, really
okay. So
bring you right.
What
back
would
into
an alternative? We've only got 5 minutes left, but and we're going to carry this on, obviously. But mm-hmm. what would be an alternative for you if? Instead of the criminal controlling which is what the case is now, the criminal controls the recovery, the compensation, the legal procedure, the political system. It's all controlled by the perpetrator. So what's an alternative for survivors and other people who are their allies? What would that be in your mind, an alternative? I mean, obviously, we do it on our own. We stay independent. We do our own, have our own organizations and actions. But what comes to mind for you about an alternative?
You know, I think the relation, it's such a fragile, it can be a very fragile thing. Yes, being independent and trusting that voice. I mean, really going after the information and trusting the information that comes, but then not being satisfied, like getting the details of what it is that you're revealing to yourself and having that information there and saying, okay, I know that this is how I'm feeling and I'm going to validate myself in this, and knowing that here's what people need to know: you're going to stand alone. This is not, there's not a really yep. a big connected system in place, although I would love to see something like, you know, maybe what you and I can do, and others especially that we're connecting with, that could create a system that would support this. But you've got to understand that your own courage is really valuable, and you are going to go into this alone, and you are your best healer, because you are
right.
you are the one that knows your own truth. And so that process and what that journey looks like is going to be, it could be very arduous. It's going to be individual, but then there's also this other aspect that there's real people that are not connected to these big entities that can understand and can help. Now, you know, I guess we could do a whole different show on how
yeah.
to navigate all of that, but really just trusting yourself, I think, is a thing, and acting in
exactly.
your own best interest on your own. And I really thought maybe I might be able to find, you know, a group to work with on this. And my journey spoke of a solitary journey, and that's the truth. It's a true hero's journey that you've traveled, that I've traveled, that other
yep.
survivors that I know have traveled. It is yours, and it ends up being golden. You end up having the treasure at the end of all of this. I can guarantee that,
right.
but the process through which going into that with your eyes open might
yeah.
be a little difficult, but it is yours.
Self-reliance, and it's a hard thing for people who've been raised in slavery and under oppression to learn, but there's no easy way around this. It comes down to self-reliance and reaching out to people and making a stink. You know, I like the Saul Alinsky, one of the community organizers, said, the smaller you are, the bigger stink you have to make, right? Because that's the only thing
yeah.
the system understands. When vested interests are upset, and you make a loud noise. And, you know, I always use the example of us. It's only when Big Van occupying those churches that they began to talk about apologies, right? We threaten them, right? And Sun Tzu says in the Art of War, and that's a good lesson. Deb, we've run out of time. I want to really thank you. And, of course, you know, you will be back on as a host of the show. You've got invaluable lessons and a brave, incomparable woman, in my opinion, because you've come through so much in your personal recovery. And so it's an honor to always have you with me. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And for all the listeners, we're going to be back with Ken, of course, next week. Follow our work, murderbydecree.com. And also, especially in the coming period, remember these dates. January the 15th, 5th anniversary of the Proclamation of the Republic of Canada, outside the criminal crown jurisdiction. We're holding common law training workshops on January 18th in Vancouver, and January the 25th in Toronto. Write to republicofcanada@gmail.com for more information on that. Go to Amazon for all of our books under Kevin Annett, and that's two N's and two T's, folks, not a net. And also, we need your involvement in the coming period, so please write to me personally at thecommonland@gmail.com, to establish the personal contact, you know, because I find the response these days is better all the time, but we have to make that leap from simply acknowledging something to doing something on the ground where we live, and that's where our power is. It always has been. That's what's changed things on the ground. So I want to thank you all for tuning in today. Take what you've learned today and apply it in your own lives. We're going to end with Bob Marley, Redemption Song. It says it all, folks. Until next week, stay strong, stay clear. I thank you.